You're listening to TIP.
On today's show, I'm joined by Jonathan Boyer to discuss his newest release of The Forgotten 40, which include his firm's top 40 stocks they like going into 2024. Jonathan is the president of Boyer's Intrinsic Value Research and is also a principal of Boyer Asset Management, which has been managing money utilizing a value-oriented strategy since 1983. Jonathan's team has a history of finding stocks that outperform. For example, over the past 7 years, the average annual return of stocks profiled in their all-cap publication returned 18.9% versus 15.1% for the S&P 500. During this episode, Jonathan and I chat about how a company makes a list of the Forgotten 40, potential catalysts Jonathan looks for in his investments, why Uber remained on the Forgotten 40 list after being the list's top performer in 2023, Jonathan's thoughts on the underperformance of small cap stocks since 2015, an overview of Interactive Brokers stock, why Bill Ackman has taken a massive stake in Howard Hughes, why Jonathan likes Madison Square Garden Sports Corporation, and much more. When reading the names in the Forgotten 40, I was particularly interested in Interactive Brokers. It's a founder-led company with an impressive track record of historical growth and profitability, and still appears to have a long growth runway ahead. In the past year alone, they've increased their customer base by over 20%, and over the past 10 years, the total number of accounts has increased by an average of 26% per year. They also seem to have a strong competitive moat given their focus on investing in new technologies and providing the lowest fees possible for their customers. Us investors here in the US are pretty used to paying little to no fees in our investment accounts, but much of Interactive Brokers' customer base is abroad, where oftentimes it's actually illegal for brokers to charge zero fees. With the strong balance sheet they have, there's also a lot of potential for new acquisitions on the horizon. Without further delay, I bring you today's chat with Jonathan Boyer.
You are listening to the Investors Podcast. Since 2014, we studied the financial markets and read the books that influence self-made billionaires the most. We keep you informed and prepared for the unexpected. Now for your host, Clay Fink.
Welcome to the Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Clay Fink, and today I'm thrilled to be joined by Jonathan Boyer. Jonathan, it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited.
So this past weekend, I received your annual research that your team puts out. It's known as the Forgotten 40 is what you call it. And this list, it highlights 40 of your firm's best stock ideas. And you've actually been kind enough to come on the show to discuss a few of these. And I'm super excited to dive in. Before we talk about the stocks, how about you just give a brief overview of what the Forgotten 40 is, what it isn't, and what it takes for a company to make the list?
Absolutely. The Forgotten 40 is one of our most popular products, and it's a little bit of an anomaly for us. So just by way of background, the firm was started by my father in 1975 as a research boutique to look for companies the way an acquirer would. What would Warren Buffett pay for an entire business? And that's kind of the thrust of the service. And we're long-term patient investors. In fact, Barron's once called my dad the world's most patient investor. I'm not as patient as he is, but I'm pretty patient. And my dad's still very much involved with the firm. We do these monthly or almost monthly research reports that take a 3 to 5 year kind of time horizon, which is an anomaly with Wall Street research. But we realized not everyone is as patient as we are. So since the 1990s, we've been publishing something called The Forgotten 40, which contains our 40 best ideas for the year ahead. And they're not our cheapest names. They're names, in order to get into the publication, we had to have profiled it in one of our full length reports. And we think there has to be a catalyst for meaningful capital appreciation in the coming year. So we do this via one page snapshots, gets sent to everyone between Christmas and New Year's, gets printed, and we're old fashioned. We still send everything via hard copy. While these reports are one page in length, there's a lot of meat behind it. It's not just us sitting around the table and saying, hey, Intel looks cheap, which it's not in the Forgotten 40, by the way, but just, as an example, we had to have profiled Intel before. So people love utilizing it as a reference guide. And it's really helpful for me as a portfolio manager when I'm starting out the year. I have a list of 40 stocks to choose from, and it's a good kind of update internally. Our team does a lot of work to do it. We have 4 great analysts, plus myself and my father, and it's something we enjoy doing, and it's something we think our subscribers like to receive.
And part of, you know, analyzing and constructing a portfolio is turning over rocks, and having 40 names to sort of look through and take a look at is fun, especially when you have a team that, you know, does a lot of the heavy lifting. And in the Forgotten 40, you have the essentially a 1-page overview of each company. And it's super useful just because you can get a broad overview of what the thesis is and what you guys are sort of thinking. And since you guys do this every year, I thought it'd be interesting to talk about how 2023 fared for last year's issue of the Forgotten 40.
Yeah, it was, for a value manager, we actually did quite well. I don't know the exact in front of me. I think it was roughly we were up 15 or so percent, give or take, which significantly beat the Russell 2000 value, which was 8%. And it also beat the S&P 500 equal weight. It didn't beat the S&P 500, as, you know, we're an equal weighted 40 stock portfolio, and to beat the Magnificent 7 would have been a hard feat to do, but we were proud of the results. We've been doing this for a long time. And it's also, you know, there are times where the performance is great, there are times where it's not as good. What I would say is no one buys every stock in it. I think it's just a great kind of idea generator, and we want people to think, you know, what's the year going to look like? What type of stocks do I want to invest in? Maybe I have cash coming in the door in January. How do I deploy it?
I think it's really important you mentioned that you have that page where you show the performance of the Forgotten 40, and that's equal weighted, which is honestly unfair. Much of success in investing is how you weigh your positions. And just look at the S&P 500 is a prime example. The S&P 500 heavily weights towards the bigger companies. When you're weighed towards the Magnificent 7, you tend to have pretty good performance with the way they've done over the past years.
But remember, it also works both ways. Right before the financial crisis, I think I read it yesterday, the day before, I had forgotten the statistics, but the financial sector was almost a quarter of the S&P 500. Mm. So you live by the sword, you die by the sword. So it's, I'm not saying what happened to financial stocks is going to happen to technology stocks, but when you have 10 stocks that are 32% of an index, most of which are in the technology space, kind of broadly defined, things can get a little dicey.
You emphasize the long-term approach in how your team thinks. So I'd think that a good number of the companies really don't change from year to year, just because it takes time for the market to recognize the value that your team's seeing. So how many of the 40 names in this year's report are repeat from last year's, and how much does that tend to change more broadly?
I'd say on average, it's about 50% turnover, because throughout the year, we're coming up with new ideas. And almost by definition, if we like the ideas that we're coming up with, they'll be decently represented in the Forgotten 40. Plus, you want to take blasts from the past, so things that we, you know, might have profiled 5-10 years ago that we've been tangentially following, and see that there's a catalyst on the horizon for value realization. So we just want to pick our 40 best stocks while we're cognizant of not having 40 financial names or 40 industrial names. We just want to have put the best roster out there in a variety of industries, variety of market caps. But I think it's interesting that this year's class, 19 of the 40 names are sub 10 billion in market cap, which is the high end of the Russell 2000 value. And the vast majority of those 19 are in the like 5 billion or less range, you know, roughly. So we're heavily weighted. You know, everyone's definition of small cap is a bit different, but we're of the belief that small cap is set for a renaissance. And, you know, 2024, could it be the year of the small cap? Possibly. If not this year, maybe next year. But that's a big theme of ours.
Another word that stuck out to me when you talked about the list was the word catalyst. And you're looking for potential catalysts in a lot of these names over the coming 12 months to see value unlocked. And for example, this might be a company. It might be a small cap. It's a size where a private equity firm could come in, take it over, purchase it at a premium to what the market's trading at. And that's how that value ends up getting unlocked. So what have you learned in your career about investing in this manner of looking for catalysts and looking for these near-term events that unlock value?
Because of the way we look at companies through the lens of an acquirer and that they're cheap by an acquisition candidate's, you know, standards, a fair amount of the names that we profile end up being acquired. Actually, two from last year's list were a company called Univar and Hostess Brands were both acquired. And being a takeout is never the sole reason for owning a business because or writing about a business, because that could take a long time. But you want to have a reason for owning it. And my father has instilled in me, you can find the greatest company in the world selling at a cheap price, but if it doesn't ascend in value, doesn't do you any good. There has to be a reason, a change, something that will make the market recognize what you're seeing. And, you know, realistically, does a catalyst happen within that 1 year? Who knows? I mean, that's just kind of an arbitrary calendar date. But we found it helpful. And there's different schools of thought. There are investors who I respect a lot who think value is its own catalyst. I just happen to, you know, I guess it's the way I was taught, think you want to look for these realizations and reasons for it. So we try and tell a story. Why is the stock going to go up over a reasonable period of time? And generally, I mean, with the exception of the Forgotten 40, a reasonable period of time is 2 to 3 years.
I can't help but think of Elon's Twitter takeover and thinking about a private equity taking over a company. Is there some sort of bias where they're looking at the share price and they're just like, hey, we're just going to tack on a 20% premium. So they're not necessarily looking at the true underlying value of the company. They're just saying, hey, we're going to buy out shareholders at a 20% premium there. What have you seen in that regards from your experience? Or is there just a wide range of premiums that industry like private equity is looking to pay?
I mean, I think it's a case by case basis. I mean, private equity, I've said some of the savviest investors there, while there's a lot of capital chasing deals, you know, they want to make money and they want to own, they have to own the underlying business. So they have to like the underlying business. So I you know, they have to usually have some sort of premium unless it's a take under. But I think it's a case by case basis. And you probably, the smaller in the cap spectrum you go, the higher the probably the premium it is, because it just might not be reflected in the price. And it also depends, is this an owner operated business? You know, they're not going to sell just for a 20% premium. They're only going to sell when they think they're really getting more than fair value for the company.
You mentioned value potentially being a catalyst, and I mentioned the private equity taking over a business and paying a premium for the company. Are there any other sort of catalysts that you seem to come up as a recurring theme?
There's lots of different catalysts. I mean, there's, could they do a massive share buyback? Could they spin out a division, an asset sale? Could they make an attractive acquisition? One of the names I think we'll probably talk about, you know, Interactive Brokers. Is there an octogenarian, an 80-year-old man with no heir apparent who owns a lot of stock? Sooner or later, himself or his or her heirs sell the business. Well, the guy at Interactive Brokers, I think, is 79. He's getting close to octogenarian status. There's lots of different reasons for a company to go up in price. You just have to try and pinpoint it. Could it be included in an index? You know, one of the things, you know, we had Uber last year, and I believe one of the catalysts we cited was inclusion in the S&P 500, because they were finally, at least we thought, going to become GAAP profitable for a full year, which would lead to index inclusion. And that was a catalyst. And Uber is far from a traditional value stock.
Right. I actually had a note here. I wanted to mention Uber. It was actually the biggest winner of last year's report for you. The stock rose by over 130%. And like you mentioned, it's not your kind of traditional value type play. It's growing quite fast. And it's really in an industry that I think a lot of people view as a winner take all industry, where the dominant player ends up taking most, if not all the profits. And Uber's market cap at the time of recording is $119 billion at the share price of $58 a share. So talk more about Uber. I'm really curious to hear, you know, despite it being the biggest winner of last year, it still remained on this year's list.
Yeah, no, we're still riding with Uber. It's can't promise another 100% gain, but they're firing on all cylinders. They have a great CEO in Dara. They're becoming more and more profitable. They have a huge moat. I mean, Lyft is competitively disadvantaged because it's a network effect business. And, you know, it's certainly not as cheap as last year, but, you know, just because a stock goes up, not a reason to sell it. And just because a stock goes up is also not a reason not to include it in this year's list again, because we still like the business. We still think it's intrinsically undervalued. There's a long runway for growth. There's lots of things that they could be doing in terms of advertising, et cetera, that we like. And, you know, it's one of these names that I think it gets thrown out a lot, but is a long-term kind of compounding business that you want to own these for the long term. You know, stocks like these could go down 30-40%, but over the long period of time, I think the trend is up and to the right.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Have you ever wondered if there's an AI tool like ChatGPT specifically built for the stock market? A tool that not only aids you in your research and analysis process, but also allows for dynamic discussions? Today, I want to share such a tool with you called Meka. Meka is the AI-powered stock research assistant now enhanced with real-time stock data. Meka does a lot of the heavy lifting of sifting through financial statements and company data and delivers it to you nearly instantaneously, and the best part is that it's 100% free. Try it out today and ask Meka questions like, what is the financial health of Microsoft? How much cash does Copart hold on its balance sheet? What is the return on invested capital of Adobe, or millions of other prompts? Check it out today for free at Meka.com. That's Meyka.com. The dream of owning a vacation home can be daunting. From finding the best guests, to the maintenance, to organizing the cleaners after every guest stay. With Vacasa, they make that dream into a reality. As a full-service vacation home management company with vacation homes in key destinations across the U.S., they know how to make owning a vacation home easy and profitable. On top of proactive property maintenance visits by professional local teams, a data-driven booking platform, and around-the-clock support, homeowners earn on average 20% or more revenue from their vacation homes. Vacasa makes vacation home ownership easy. If you're looking to make more from your vacation home by doing less, partner with Vacasa at Vacasa.com. That's Vacasa.com to get started on your dream of owning a vacation home. Do you guys ever feel overwhelmed with all that's going on in the markets and you feel like you just can't keep up with the day-to-day news headlines? Today's show sponsor, Yahoo Finance, is my go-to solution to keeping up with today's top news and stay informed with what's happening globally. With Yahoo Finance, I'm able to see the biggest trends and biggest movers in the stock market, what's happening with interest rates, major geopolitical events, and much more. If it wasn't for Yahoo Finance, I would have no idea that Tesla is laying off 10% of their staff, or why iPhone shipments are down 9% year over year. Yahoo Finance also has a number of other cool features, including a tool that lets you link in all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings, and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts. Yahoo Finance is one of my favorite tools that I use in my investing toolkit, and it's what I read each morning to kick off my day to stay in the loop with what's happening in the markets. Join more than 90 million monthly users today and get comprehensive financial news and analysis at yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show.
And at the start of your report, you really talk about these broader themes going on in the economy. You aren't trying to invest based on the macro, but you're aware of what's happening within the bigger picture. So what are some of the bigger themes you're looking at in today's market that help you decide the types of companies you want to own or the companies you want to cover in the Forgotten 40?
It's Yeah, the macro is a dangerous thing because you can always scare yourself out of investing, as you know, as Buffett, you know, famously talks about all the bad things that happened in the 20th century, yet the Dow went from 41 to whatever it went to. And, you know, people who invested the day before Black Monday, or the people who invested the day before the crash of 87, you know, as long as they held on for a long period of time, did fine. So you try and filter out the noise as best as you can and don't let headlines scare you. Obviously, you have to be cognizant of things. And I'm someone who, when I'm buying stocks for myself or clients, I generally don't take a full position right away. As I think, you know, as I've learned, stocks can get a heck of a lot cheaper than you ever thought they could. And you want to have some dry powder there. So, yeah, so I don't know if that kind of answers the questions that you were looking for, but happy to elaborate.
Yeah, let's dive into one of the sections was on small cap stocks. Those have underperformed the S&P 500 since 2015 by around 6% per year. But interestingly, over the long run, small caps have actually tended to outperform the broader market. I pulled a stat here on small caps from 1926 through July of 2023. Small cap value has produced 4 percentage points of alpha above the S&P 500. So I'm curious to get your take on the underperformance since 2015. Obviously, we've seen big tech sort of take over the index and lead a lot of those gains. What do you think are some of the other reasons for a 4 percentage point gap since 2015?
Yeah, no, it's been a painful time to be in small caps. And yet the, you know, some people recently have been blaming interest rates or the rise in interest rates for that. But obviously, there were a long period of that time where interest rates were basically zero, which, you know, so that's not really the culprit, in my opinion. I think you just have to go back historically. If you look at the period before the dot-com bust, there was a long period where the Russell significantly lagged the S&P 500. And then, and I'm not saying that these periods are exactly analogous, but history tends to rhyme. The period after the dot-com bust, the S&P basically did nothing and the Russell shined. And I think we're going to enter a period such as that. And that's a period where I think stock pickers like us should do quite well, especially those who gear towards smaller cap names.
And one more part on the broader theme section I thought was quite interesting. It was the presidential election year. That's 2024. There were some interesting stats on that. I'd be curious if you have those up and you'd be able to share what a presidential election year means to you as a value investor.
Basically, the presidential election years are the second best performing years, I believe, in the presidential election cycle. And, you know, we get a lot of the data from, I buy each year the Stock Traders Almanac, which is, it's a great read. You got a lot. I mean, I'm one of these people who like statistics. And, you know, while I don't invest by it, I think it's good to kind of learn what kind of historical patterns there are. But one of the ones that I thought was interesting was, regardless of which party is the ultimate victor, in 16 of the past 18 presidential election years, the last 7 months in total have seen gains in the S&P 500. But there are big exceptions. The two exceptions were in 2000, where the results were delayed of the presidential election. I really hope that's not the case this year. And the other one, it was during the 2008 financial crisis, and I hope that as well. That doesn't occur as well. But, you know, the S&P does better when there's a sitting president in office running for re-election. So there's lots of things that you can glean from history. And, you know, it's worth noting that over the last couple of years, if you had invested the way kind of the Stock Traders Almanac had for presidential election years, you would have done quite well. So, but at the end of the day, though, I'm a stock by stock basis guy. I look at each individual company. What is it worth? What's the catalyst? You know, how are we going to get paid? But, you know, it's important to be aware of all these other things.
I can't help but think of Munger, who recently passed, and just show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome. And generally during election years, it seems that governments tend to be more accommodative to markets.
Yes. And then the year after the election, I think, is the worst part of the cycle because people realize all those great promises aren't going to occur. So it's amazing that this happens pretty consistently, but it does. But the one thing I would say is 2024 does not look like a typical election year, although maybe I don't know what a typical election year looks like. So I think all bets are out the window on it, you know. And people who are strategists, they got 2024 for the most part, 2023 for the most part, dead wrong. Nothing that they said occurred would. So I would be wary of making strategic calls for the year. I think you're better off being, you know, more strategic in the stocks that you pick and not macro outlook.
Right. I recently saw a tweet that looked at all the big banks, all these big firms and their outlook for how the S&P 500 would end in 2023. Like hardly any of them predicted a gain of over 10%, yet the S&P was up over 20% on the year.
Yeah, no, if you were going, you know, everyone thought, say, be defensive in 2023 and buy dividend paying stocks and all these other things that were the laggards. And I just think, listen, there's lots of different ways to invest. To me, it makes more sense to know about the companies you're investing in. You know, one thing, you know, just going back about, you know, the outlook for the year and things such as that, that I think is important to know, you know, one of the things you might have noticed in the Forgotten 40 is an absence of energy names. Those are names that we've historically have avoided over the last couple of years, as energy has been the, you know, the favorite. I think it's the best performing sector since the market bottomed after, you know, during COVID. Take a 10-year view, it's been a horrible place to invest. They're capital destroying businesses, cyclical. So we, you know, while a lot of value investors think there is value in energy, you know, maybe I'll be completely wrong, but it's one that I would avoid. And another reason is you have to be right twice. Ideally, you want to buy a stock and hold it for long periods of time and let the magic of tax deferred compounding happen. And with energy names, you kind of have to trade in and out of them, and that's tax inefficient. So it's something we avoid.
Right. And there's just much more of a human element where you not only have to decide when you're going to buy, you have to decide when you're going to sell. And the more decisions you have to make, the tougher things can be. I wanted to transition here to talk about one of the names on the Forgotten 40. It's Interactive Brokers. It really appealed to me. I'm actually an avid user of Interactive Brokers, and I actually use it for all of my stock accounts. So I firsthand can say I'm a big fan of the platform. I don't own any shares, but long term, it's actually really been a phenomenal stock. I just looked in your research. You pointed that as of October 2023, they grew their number of accounts by over 20% year over year. And they've just seen impressive growth, just like top to bottom in their business. And if you're not familiar with Interactive Brokers, essentially it's just a digital platform to buy and sell stocks. And they have great fees, and I think they do a really great job. But, you know, stock investing, there's plenty of firms that do what Interactive Brokers does. Like so many people are familiar with Vanguard, Fidelity, Charles Schwab, all these, you know, these names that people are a part of. But most people are probably less familiar with Interactive Brokers. So I'm curious to get your take on how they're able to differentiate themselves with the service and what feels sort of like a commodity-like business.
Yeah, I think he's done a fantastic job of growing this business. And it looks like they have, and, you know, going back to those word compounders, you know, many years of 20% plus account growth. And in the US, it's essentially a commoditized business with Fidelity and Schwab. But that's if you just want to kind of invest in the US. The Interactive Brokers platform, you know, is easy with currency conversions. It's easy to invest throughout the world. Also, most of their accounts or vast majority are held outside the US, where people actually still do pay commissions, because payment for order flow, which is how Fidelity and Schwab are able to offer zero commission trading, it's illegal. So, and should remain so. And what they've noticed was they do have a model where there's free commissions, but yet within there, but you get worse execution, and they've had very little uptake on it. So there's value in what they do. They have low cost margin lending, you know, lots of different things that make people want to use them. And and their technology is fantastic. They try to automate everything possible. So it's, and they're really growing in the hedge fund space, especially the ones that are $50 million and below of funds. So there's lots to like about it. And we like these businesses that can continue to grow for, like an Uber, continue to grow for years and years and years and have a huge runway for success. And it's, you know, I think, and if you can buy them at a reasonable multiple, I don't have the multiple right in front of you, but it's significantly below its historic one. Over time, if you are a patient, generally good things happen.
Yeah, your report shows a PE of just under 15, and this was released in December 13th, 2023. And just the 2023 growth fiscal year, revenues grew from $3 billion to $4.3 billion. Operating income grew from $2 billion to $3.1 billion. So it's a very highly profitable business. Unlike Uber, it's kind of just crossing that threshold. But Interactive Brokers has been profitable for quite a long time.
Yeah, no, it's a history of profitability. They have they also have a pristine balance sheet. It's a lazy balance sheet. I mean, they need some of it as part of their for their business, but those are also the catalysts. Maybe they increase their dividend significantly or do a big share buyback. There are things that they could do. As I said, the CEO or the founder is almost 80 years old. Does he sell this company to another one? You know, there's a lot to like there. And it's one of these that I think are, obviously, I wish we had this show 10 years ago and people had invested in Interactive Brokers, as it's been a fantastic performer.
Yeah, the founder, who's 79 years old, he owns 68% of the shares. And then insiders overall own 76.2% of shares. And when I was looking back at Interactive Brokers history, it seems like they've sort of gone through a transformation type period, whereas roughly a decade ago, they launched this online trading portion of their business, and then they transitioned away from whatever they were doing prior to that.
They were an options market maker type of a business, and they've switched, and it was the right move, and people gravitate towards them. And you know, their marketing hasn't been particularly effective. They've just been growing via word of mouth, which is the way you want to grow your business. Obviously, you would love to have great marketing too, but the fact that if one person tells another means you have a good product out there. And yeah, it's a name that we like.
Do you know what markets they're primarily growing in?
Oh, I mean, outside the US, you know, they're growing in Australia, they're growing in Europe, they're Asia. It's kind of across the board.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4x points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4x points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
The Investors Podcast Network is launching something new that hasn't been offered in years. It was very popular when we offered it years ago, and we're bringing it back again. We've launched a new stock investing course that dives deep into the first principles of sound investment strategies and explores a variety of relevant investing topics, ranging from the fundamental differences between active and passive investors, how to build and monitor a stock portfolio, tips for optimizing your retirement savings, and much more. For a limited time, all We Study Billionaires listeners get 15% off with the code WSB15 when you visit theinvestorspodcast.com/stock course. That's code WSB15 at theinvestorspodcast.com/stock course, or simply click the link in the show notes for this episode.
All right, back to the show.
Yeah, and another thing that sort of sticks out to me about this industry is the switching costs seem to be somewhat high. I'm speaking from experience where I call my broker. I'm like, how the heck do I get this transferred over to Interactive Brokers? And they just make you jump through all these hoops. They called five different people just to try and make it happen. So that was quite annoying, to be honest. But the stickiness, once you have a happy customer, they really have no incentive to leave when they're getting low fees. They get offered everything they need within the platform they're on at that time.
Well, especially in one of the areas that they're trying to grow in these like RIA space, where those are extremely sticky, because once you have all your clients signed up, where you're now the custodian and broker of record for them, no one wants to have an excuse for a client to leave, and that gives you an excuse. So it's a really good, it's a good business, high switching cost. It's a very, very different business than Fidelity and Schwab.
You noted the enormous runway they have. Here I'm looking at the report. 2.5 million accounts are under Interactive Brokers. Charles Schwab, not a direct comparison, you're right. They have 34 million accounts, and then Fidelity has 43 million. I'm curious to get your take on, obviously, the U.S. competitive landscape is pretty tricky given we can have zero trading fees at a lot of these firms. What does the competitive landscape look like outside the U.S. and how that looks, given that zero commission trading is illegal in many of these markets?
Yeah, it significantly advantages Interactive Brokers because they're the low cost provider. As they built the infrastructure, they've built the technology, and they have a great platform. So it's favorable. They're growing much faster, high single digit growth, in the U.S., which is far below what it is outside the U.S. So it's something that, that will continue to grow it.
I wanted to also mention Howard Hughes, another company outlined in your report. It's ticker HHH. Bill Ackman has actually been quite active in this stock. At the end of Q3 2023, Ackman's firm Pershing Square had a $1.2 billion stake in the company, and he's been purchasing shares throughout the year. And it looks like over half of his shares were accumulated in the drop in March of 2020, when the stock got hammered from $120 all the way to as low as 40. And according to your report, Ackman's firm Pershing Square owns 37% of Howard Hughes. So talk to us about what you're seeing in this name.
This is a name that Ackman made a lot of money in. It was from General Growth Properties and after the financial crisis. And Howard Hughes is a master plan community developer in really favorable areas of the country: Texas, Nevada, Phoenix, Hawaii. And you had mentioned that he bought a lot of his shares during COVID. And that was, I think, out of an abundance of caution. The company didn't want to have any liquidity issues. So he's chairman of the company. They issued shares, and he was by far the largest buyer of it. And he bought it in the 50s. It's now in the 80s. In retrospect, it wasn't a great deal, but you didn't know what was happening with COVID at the time. And he wanted to make sure the company was alive to, fight another day. And shareholders were given the same opportunity to buy shares as well. So he's allowed to buy up to, I believe, 40% of the company. Every time the stock gets below 75, it seems that he buys more. So there's, sort of an Ackman put in the $75 range. It wouldn't shock us if he takes the company private, or if he merges it with his open-ended, publicly traded fund, because he wants that to be listed in the U.S. and you need an operating business. I don't know exactly how the mechanics of that would work, but that's been a long rumored thing that would happen. But either way, they have they have 36,000 acres of raw land to develop, 36,000 acres. They have a long runway to increase net operating income for years to come. There's also the Catalyst, where they also own the South Street Seaport in Manhattan and some other assets in Las Vegas, that they're spinning those out into a separately publicly traded company in 2024. And that should make it a pure play master plan community, which, you know, hopefully will give it a higher valuation. And maybe instead of spinning it out, someone ends up buying it. Who knows? I'm talking about the spun off part. And it's not particularly well covered on Wall Street. About five analysts cover it. And if you look at other home builders or, you know, other, you know, REITs, they're significantly more, I mean, and they're not a home builder. They really are a seller of land, but they have much less coverage, which leads to valuation discrepancies.
You mentioned 37,000 acres of raw land, and it's quite interesting to think about that aspect, because it requires some digging to figure out, okay, how much is all this land worth? You got Phoenix, Nevada, Hawaii. How much research do you guys do in terms of figuring out how much all this is really worth and figuring out a fair value for the overall company? Because I think some investors can sort of get into trouble and assume, okay, Nevada land, it's probably worth this much. And, you know, just kind of oversimplifying things, and land values just across, you know, different areas of a city can just, you know, change so, so much. So yeah, talk more about the land.
Well, yeah, and land is, you know, at historical cost, so the balance sheet is not much help. But we, in our initial initiation report, we went through all the different properties and what they're worth. And yeah, no, it's a ton of digging. It's a ton of work. Our team does a fantastic job with that. And generally, we use very conservative assumptions. We'd rather be surprised on the upside.
And do they generally just reinvest everything back into redeveloping these, or how does the capital allocation look?
Well, that's what also makes them unique. They're not a REIT, so they don't have to dividend back everything. So they invest it into the company, which is also a competitive advantage. And they do it and they grow it. And it's a, you know, a virtuous cycle where they're able to control the supply of land within an individual community. So they build one of these master plan communities, they make it nice and sell X amount of land to developers, which then, and commercial operations, which then makes the raw land they have there even more valuable. And they keep doing that. So they keep a tight lid on supply and demand of supply of the raw land. So they're very strategic of what they do. And, you know, one of the things is it probably shouldn't be a public company, because you have to take a 10, 15, 20 year time horizon for these type of investments. But, you know, it's selling at a decent discount to what we perceive NAV to be. And I think NAV will grow significantly over time as they develop more land.
And then is there any more near-term catalysts that stand out to you? I could see some investors just looking at the current net operating income and plugging a multiple on that. Is there anything with, you know, maybe in the near term that might be more so of a catalyst outside of a takeover?
Yeah, well, I think they're spinning out the South Street Seaport this year, as well as some assets they own in Vegas, including a part of a minor league baseball team, I believe. So that's a catalyst, and that could make it more of a pure play type of company, and analysts can do a better job of figuring out what it's worth.
There were a couple of other names I wanted to mention that I was sort of just looking at the valuation of some of these names. One of them was Markel. It seemed to be one of the more undervalued names on your list. And at the time of your research, you estimated the intrinsic value of Markel to be around $24.88. And that valuation was based on some of the parts. And the share price at the time of publication was $13.88. So that implies potential upside of 79%. And immediately my mind thinks about how companies like Markel and Berkshire Hathaway have sort of always had this conglomerate discount. So I'm curious to get your thoughts more generally on investing in this manner of some of the parts or discount to intrinsic value, how that tends to work out over time, given you guys have done this type of research since the 90s.
I mean, the two examples you gave of conglomerate discounts, people have owned Markel and certainly Berkshire for 30 years, even if it traded at a discount to what it should be, you know, because it's a conglomerate, have still been handsomely rewarded. So, you know, if you buy great companies, generally good things will happen. You just want to make sure you have good stewards of capital. Tom Gaynor, who runs Markel, good investor, very conservative, runs a good operation. They started something called Markel Ventures, I don't know, roughly 10 years ago or so, where they're investing in private companies and, you know, they're dubbed the baby Berkshire. And, you know, it's one of these, they're growing book value over time and, you know, in a conservative, prudent manner. They have a nice stock portfolio that's done quite well. And I think the private equity part of the business, the ventures part, will become more and more meaningful. They just need to do a better job of underwriting, as it hasn't been ideal for them.
And we had talked outside of this that we're both friends with Chris Mayer, and Chris mentioned on our show that he solely focuses on compounders and he quit investing in names based on some of the parts, discount to peers, et cetera. He said it took him quite a bit of time to sort of make that transition. And it's quite interesting just learning about all these different approaches of how people think about risk and valuation and time horizon, all that.
Well, Chris is a great guy and a great investor. And, you know, he wrote a fantastic book called 100 Baggers, which I recommend everyone read. And he's right. You know, you want to invest in these compounders. And I don't want to invest in something that's a sum of the parts story that's a mediocre business. That's just one part of it. You know, in some ways, you know, Howard Hughes is a sum of the part play business. But I also like, it's selling at a discount, but I also like the underlying business and this growth prospect. So you can have your cake and eat it too in this. You just have to be very selective. Chris has the advantage of running an extremely concentrated portfolio where I think he probably has 10 or 15 stocks in it. So when you have to pick 40, it's a little harder to do that. But yeah, no, I fully agree. You want, it's not just, oh, this is selling, a stock is selling at 15 times earning. It is historically sold at 20. It's peer sell at 20, let's buy it in hopes that there's, you know, mean reversion. Well, it could also go the other way where their peers just don't do as well. So it's, you want to have a reason for owning the underlying business, not just these special situations.
I fully agree. It's why I wanted to mention Interactive Brokers and Markel. Like Markel especially, they have these diversified revenue streams. You have Tom Gaynor, just a very long track record of treating shareholders fairly and being a good capital allocator. And then they have the stock portfolio. And then one point you made in your report in regarding to the venture side is they haven't been able to make as many deals with lower interest rates and just so much competition. But now with higher interest rates and the really strong balance sheet they have, it's their time to be more opportunistic and finding those deals and putting that cash to work.
Yeah. And what I like about them is they didn't chase things. They didn't try and buy. It's not like a private equity firm where, you know, they have to invest the money. You know, they were fine just being prudent and waiting for their time. And their time will come where there'll be less competition for private equity. People would want to sell to them and they'll be the buyer of choice. So yeah, no, it's a great operation, and they're doing a good job, and they're becoming more and more widely known, kind of in investing circles as well.
So it was interesting to read about some of these very public assets in your report. You know, companies that people see in the limelight, but they just don't really think to invest in or even know it's an option to invest in these. One of which is Madison Square Garden Sports Corporation, which you state, based on the intrinsic value calculation, you see around 99% upside from the $171 level. Talk to us about what you're seeing in this one.
Madison Square Garden is a name we've known for a long period of time. It's controlled by the Dolan family, and it suffers from the quote-unquote Dolan discount. It was initially part of Cablevision, and they've done a variety of spin-outs. And Madison Square Garden Sports owns the Knicks and the Rangers, are the primary assets of it. And you may or may not have noticed there's been a lot of activity in publicly traded sports teams or in sports teams. Private equities have got involved in a big way. Sovereign wealth funds have gotten involved in a big way. And right now, the enterprise value of Madison Square Garden Sports is roughly $4.5 billion or so. The Knicks alone, you know, Forbes values at like $6.5 billion. The Rangers are close to three, utilizing what historical premiums to Forbes value. You get a much, much higher stock price. And people say, oh, well, Dolan will never sell the team. One, I would say never say never. He did sell Cablevision at a great price, by the way, at a great time. And two, if Mark Cuban can sell the Dallas Mavericks, who everyone thought he would be a, or sell a majority stake in the Dallas Mavericks, it's not far-fetched to think that James Dolan can do the same thing. But there are other ways that they can unlock shareholder value absent a sale. They could sell one of the teams. They could sell a stake in one of the teams, which is what's happening with the, you know, Toronto Maple Leafs organization. And so there's lots of ways to win. They could buy back a lot of shares. They can pay, they've already paid one special dividend. They can pay another one. So there's a lot to like. I think you have downside protection, and these are valuable assets. And as, at least in my opinion, as long as there are billionaires with big egos, the price of these sports teams are just going to increase in value. They're a scarce asset. There's only roughly 30 NBA teams. And that's also a catalyst where, you know, there's rumored that they're going to do expand by one or two teams, and that there's going to be an expansion fee, and that will be divvied up by all of the teams, and the Knicks will share in that revenue stream. In addition, they have, I believe in a year or so, their media rights for the NBA come up. That's, they're going to have a, it hasn't been renegotiated in about 10 years. There's going to be a significant bump up there. So there's lots of reasons why the stock could go up significantly, even absent a sale of the teams.
Talk more about the Dolan discount. Is it just a factor of him not wanting to sell, or is there something else there?
Oh, I mean, for those of your listeners who are in the New York area, they know all too well the trials and tribulations of James Dolan. There's actually a great podcast series out there called Reign of Error, which details the Dolan empire and what they have done. And, you know, they've been terrible operators of at least the Knicks. They've been, you know, until recently, they've had terrible record. They've owned the team since the 1990s, and he's probably one of the least liked people in New York. He's done things like, you might have seen his stories with facial recognition going into Madison Square Garden, where anyone who is suing them or worked at a law firm that is suing them can't go in. He does not get good press, and that gets reflected in the stock price. But I look at, you know, as we followed Cablevision and owned Cablevision for long periods of time, we made a lot of money, and our clients made a lot of money in Cablevision, and he eventually sold it. I think if you take a longer term perspective, these discounts can turn into opportunities.
Great. Well, Jonathan, I really appreciate you joining me on the show today. Before I let you go, I want to give you a handoff to how the audience can learn more about the Forgotten 40 and learn more about your firm and any other resources you'd like to share.
First, it was a pleasure being on your show. It was a lot of fun, and I can't believe, you know, an hour or whatever it is, it kind of just flew by. Yeah, for those who want to know more about the Forgotten 40, you just go to BoyerResearch.com/2024. You get all the information you need about the Forgotten 40, including some samples from this year's. And, you know, one of the things that we did that's new to Boyer in 2023 was we started a Substack that has paid and premium content. And it's, we put it up basically a stock idea a month for paid subscribers. And that's at BoyerResearch.substack.com. Yeah, I'd encourage people to go there or just go to BoyerValueGroup.com to learn more about what we do. And, you know, we're very different than traditional Wall Street. And, you know, we'd love to hear from you.
Well, if anyone who's listening enjoyed the chat and they're interested in the Forgotten 40, I'll be sure to get that linked in the show notes. So, Jonathan, thanks again for joining me. I really enjoyed reading through your research, and it was great having you on the show. It's always fun as a stock picker to be able to look through a list of that has a ton of research behind it, and you can kind of pick and choose the types of companies you're looking for, which is amazing because you have quite a variety to pick from. And just thank you for coming on, and thank you for all that you did.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, and I look forward to staying in touch, and thanks for your time, and this was a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to TIP. and make sure to subscribe to Millennial Investing by the Investors Podcast Network and learn how to achieve financial independence. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.